Good morning.
Morning.
I was thinking about what Bill said about our pledge. You know, when he first said that, the first thing that came to my mind was money. And then after a bit of time, I thought, well, that's really inaccurate. Our pledge isn't about money. The money is a symbol. And it's a symbol of our commitment to our pledge to a liberal religious community in which we care about, in which we love, and a liberal religious voice in this community, which we know is needed in the most severe way. So when we think about our pledge, let's get past the money and think about our life as a community and our life as having a prophetic voice in a time when that prophetic voice is needed. And then when we had the reading about the Maccabean spirit, the spirit that shook its fist in the face of the Roman Empire for over 100 years and said, we will not be oppressed. And if we could have that spirit connected to our sense of pledge and have that be our guiding energy for the next year, I think that would be a good thing. Today we're going to continue and hopefully complete the story of the wounded swan. And last week I introduced that story, and I wanted to talk about briefly the three characters that are in that story. And the first character we have in that story is an 11-year-old boy named Savasti. Savasti is classified and labeled as an untouchable. There are five castes in his society. They're the caste of the priest, they're the caste of the religious leaders, then there is the caste of the rulers, of the princes, of the judge, and then there is the caste of the merchants, and then there is the caste of those who serve these people, and all of those people get to live in the city, get to live in the village. But Savasti, he is not even considered in a caste. He is not even classifiable. He is an untouchable. And if this untouchable touches one of these other five, he would be beaten. And he was told this story, and he was told this reality by his father. And I was reminded of a relationship I had with an African-American man when I was in training, and he took it out of the kindness of his heart to teach me some things over a period of 3 years. And one of the things that he taught me was that in the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s, he said, in which those were the eras of when he was a young man, he said that the grandmothers would teach the best of us men not to demonstrate who we were out in society, not to demonstrate our goodness and our abilities and our capacities out in the community, because if we did, we would be putting ourselves in danger because the oppression was so severe. And I think that's the same thing that was going on with Savasti. He could not be his truest self, because if he was his truest self and he were to claim his truest self, he would be beaten and he would be persecuted. And this is what his father knew. So his father taught him, you are an untouchable, and don't challenge that system. The other character is Sujata, a young girl, 13 years old, and she is the daughter of one of the chiefs in the village. So her attitude about herself is one of pride and excitement and openness. And as the story goes on, you will be able to tell the two differences between these two children and how they respond to the teaching of Buddha the Wounded Swan. What else happened in this story before this story was told by Buddha to these two children is that he had a meal with them. And in this meal, these children knew that they were not to eat together. These children knew they could not share food together and sit down in the same place and share food. But as the Buddha sat down with him and asked Savasti to share his rice and asked Sujata to share her rice, they did so with thought, but without question. These children knew somehow they were in the presence of a teacher, and when the teacher said to do something in an attitude of gentleness and an attitude of care, they followed what teacher was leading them to do, even though they knew it was against the customs and the traditions from which they came, which is an indication of their attitude to the person that they chose to be their teacher. They were open to that teaching. And as they were finished eating, and he suggested that they eat in quiet, and as they were finishing, he began to tell this story of the wounded swine. The story was followed by the statement that Buddha made to the children, that talking about the caste system and talking about classism, his teaching said that everybody's tears are salty, that everybody's blood is red. And what he's trying to say is, this is the reality. And beyond this reality, we create illusions, we create teachings, and we create teachings that oppress other people. The reality is, we are all the same. We are not different. And then he tells this story of the wounded swan. And he says, as he was walking along one day as a child, he was about 13 or 14 himself, and he's walking along, and as he's walking along, this swan falls from the sky with an arrow in the wing. So he feels compassion, and he picks up the swan, he takes it home, he pulls the arrow out, he's bandaging up this swan, he's figuring out, how am I going to take care of this swan, I need to feed this swan, and all of a sudden his cousin comes charging through the door and says, Siddhartha, have you seen a swan? I shot it, and I can't find it. And then his cousin sees the swan over there and starts running to get the swan, and Siddhartha, Buddha, steps in the middle and says, stop, you can't have that swan. And his cousin says, what are you talking about? I can't have this swan. That swan was flying freely, and I shot it, and because I shot it, I own it. It is now mine, and I can do with that swan what I want to do with. And at that point, Siddhartha said, and the story says, I was so mad I could just punch him. But he didn't punch him. So in a way, he was frozen with the logic that when something is free and I have the power to dominate that thing that is free, it is mine. And these were the values of that culture. These were the values that moved Savasti into being an untouchable. That because I have power to dominate, I can possess. And when Siddhartha, the future Buddha, heard that, he froze and was angry because he didn't know what to say. So an answer finally comes to him, and he says, wait a minute. Love is about people being together and caring for people. And because you shot this swan, you are the enemy of this swan. And because you are the enemy of this swan doesn't want to be with you. But I love this swan. And I understand what this swan's going through, and I want to be this swan, and this swan wants to be with me. And he says, because of that, you can't have the swan. And then Sajanta, the one who's strong, young girl, good, solid ego, says, that's right! And she cheers him on. But Savasti, he doesn't respond. And so Siddhartha looks over, Buddha looks over at Savasti, says, well, what do you think? And we have a pause at that moment in time, because his answer is either going to affirm domination and oppression in which he is a citizen of that culture, or his answer is going to move and transform him into a way of love and understanding in which he is being taught. This is a moment of truth. This is the great pause in all of our lives. When somebody asks us a specific question in which we have to wrestle with. Now, it may seem like this is a simple story, and that's a reasonable question. However, Buddha, in order to come to the place where he would teach, has a story of its own. And that story of where he would bring himself to teach needs to be told in order to understand the story with Savasti and understand the tension and the pausing of that decision. When Buddha was a young man, he was a son of a king, and he was a prince, and he lived in royalty. And in his young life, he struggled between being wealthy and also the suffering and the poor and what was going on in his community and the difference of his life and between those who were poorer than him and who suffered where he did not experience that suffering. And so when he was a young man, he went on his journey to seek out the way, to seek out the understanding of suffering and how to move beyond suffering. And so he left his house, and he left his house in secret. And it's very curious, because if we thought about it today, he left his mother, he left his father, he left his wife, he left a child, he left his servants. He left a community that loved him. He had a drive, a spiritual drive, to discover something that moved him beyond a situation that was very comfortable, in which he could be king one day. He said no to that. And so he leaves, and he goes and he says goodbye to his servant, and his servant's crying and says, "Don't leave, don't do this." And he says, "I've got to do this." So he sends his servant home, and he leaves, and he goes into the woods. And when he goes into a woods, it's curious, when he goes into a woods, he sees somebody in the robe of a monk. And then he also notices this person who has this robe on, whom at first he thinks a monk, is also carrying a bow and arrow. And he says to him, "What's going on? You've got this robe as a monk and you're carrying..." He says, "Are you really a hunter?" And the guy says, "Yeah, I'm a hunter." And he says, "Well, what are you wearing this robe for of a monk?" He says, "Well, the animals love the monks, and the animals come up to the monks nice and easy, and when they do that, I get to shoot them and kill them easy." And Buddha says, "Wait a minute. This is not cool. You know, there's something wrong with this picture. You can't do that. It's dishonest." And as he talks to the hunter, he says, "Why don't you take my robes, the robes that are royal robes and are worth money, and allow me to have your robe, which is the robe of a monk." He's already challenging the discrepancy between values. He's already challenging that which is dishonest at this point. And he moves on and he finds a master. And he asks this master, he says, "Can I become your student?" And the master says, "Yes, you can become my student." And the first thing that the master teaches him, he says, "You must learn to breathe." Now that may seem funny, because we kind of breathe all the time. He says, "No, you must learn to breathe in order to concentrate. And then when you learn to breathe and you learn to concentrate, the next thing you must do is you must let go of the past, and you must let go of the future. You must free yourself of your past, and you must free yourself of your future in order to wrestle with the realm of no materiality. In order to wrestle with how you place yourself and how you identify yourself and how you understand yourself in this world, you must let go of your future. You must let go of your past." Not an easy thing to do. I do counseling in my other life. And in this counseling process, what I have come to try to understand what is health, spiritual and psychological health. One of the models, I guess, and one of the understandings that I use is that I need to have some understanding of my life story, where I can go back prior to my conception and prior to my birth, and I'm able to move through my whole life story with a sense of compassion and understanding. And when I can move through with some fluidity my whole life story within my imagination with compassion and with understanding, I'm able to let go of my past. I'm able to let go of the anxiety about the future. And I know from 20 years of practicing and coming to that understanding, this is not an easy thing to do. Because I'll go into my past and I'll start coming through my past and I'll remember the time something hurtful, something harmful to happen, and I'll stop and I'll want to not deal with that part of my history and my story. There are parts of my story I don't want to tell. There are parts of my story I forget. So how could I possibly tell the part of my story that I forget? How do I become familiar with how to let go of my past and not have anxiety about the future? What this master was telling Buddha to do is, you have to take some time. before you can even attempt that, you have to learn to breathe and concentrate before you can move in that direction. And then, after you master that, moving into the realm of no materiality, you've got to come to the understanding that everything is an illusion outside of you, and that it is you who creates the world. Now, talk to a culture that's commercialized and materialized, and our attachments are all in the outside and attached to what vehicle, what home, how we look, what clothes, how our home is. How in the world do I possibly believe, as I imitate this world, to feel okay about myself? Am I to believe that I create that world? Malcolm X, when he talks about in the 1960s struggling for the black identity of a community, he comes up with a term called radical self-love. And this is something Savasti's struggling with in this story. Radical self-love means understanding that when you live in oppression, when you live in an abusive environment, the human tendency is to take the attitude of the oppressor, to take the beliefs of the abuser, and interpret yourself from their perspective. Savasti believes he is an untouchable because the oppressive community tells him he is an untouchable. And he internalizes the belief that he is an untouchable. And he is living out of a, he is living out a story that somebody else wrote for him. Because when he was born, if you were to ask him to write his own story, he would not write his story where he's an untouchable. It's somebody else's story he is living out. So how is he to come to the place where he says, I create my reality? The best that I can understand that is that somehow I must pull in my capacity to reach out and understand the world. I must pull in what I see. I must detach from what I see and pull into myself. I must detach from what I smell, from what I taste, from what I touch. I must close myself down and move with inside myself and detach from the external world and recognize that in a way I am different from the external world. And then when I open my eyes, it is my perception that paints the reality. And we paint different realities. And I think this may give some credence to that. If we go back there at the pond and we look at the pond, one person may look at it and say, yeah, there's a pond in the backyard. And look, isn't it nice that it's flat? And that's how that person paints that reality. Somebody else might look at that pond and say, yeah, it's flat. But do you see that roll over there in the middle of the lake? Well, what that roll means, there's a 10-pound bass underneath that roll. So now my reality goes to how do I get my fishing pole and how do I get the bait to get that. So I'm painting that reality where somebody else might not see that, might just think this is a peaceful scene and sit down and meditate upon the peace of that scene. And that's their reality. It's the same picture. It's two different realities. And indeed, both those people are creating different realities. And we can put anything in the reality. Savasti puts in his reality that he is an untouchable. He's internalized the oppressor's view, and when he opens his eyes, he uses somebody else's paintbrush, somebody else's colors, to paint the reality. As we all do if we're not careful, because we are trained to do that. Conquering the realm of no materiality, recognizing that is indeed I who create my world. The master says, you've conquered that. You've done that. And then here comes Buddha's temptation in life. Buddha is on a path to find a way to move past anxiety, to move past suffering, to understand death. And that's his quest, to understand that. And he says, this conquering and mastering this phase and this understanding of meditation and understanding of reality, I still have anxiety in me. I still have not conquered what I wanted to do. This is his mission in life. The master says, you are a superior student. Would you please come with me be part of this community, and when I pass on, you can become the leader of this community. Buddha's already given up wealth, and here he comes to a very honorable position to be a leader in a community. Very tempting. And he says, no. He does not stop and turn around to teach because he's not done. His first temptation. Maybe the second temptation. He goes and he finds another master. And this other master, very impressed with what he has learned so far, and this other master says, now what we must do, now what you must do, is conquer not just understanding your perception of reality is an illusion out there, and you must, in a sense, detach from your perception. You must move past and understand, you must detach from your own perception. So it's not only detaching from the perception and detaching from what's going on inside of you, you must detach from non-perception. And I fully don't understand that at this point. I'm trying to wrap my mind around what does that mean. You know, so where I'm struggling with that right now is, does that mean that when I settle down, because then when I detach from everything, in a way, my mind, my consciousness still has a boundary around everything, and I can say, okay, I've got my senses shut down, my visuals, my auditory, my tasting, my touch, I've got that shut down, and I'm kind of within myself, and when I'm trying to think of this non-perception, when I felt that, I can say, but there's still a boundary around that. And best I can understand it, non-perception is the relaxing of that boundary and participating with the infinite. Wow. Okay, I want to work on that, and I want to understand that, and I want to feel that, because what that does is that puts me on a path of understanding possibly our seventh principle, that we are all part of the interdependent web of all existence. Is this spirit path that Buddha's on, does it touch our seventh principle? I think it does. I think absolutely it does. Absolutely. How wise the feminist and the environmentalist that got the seventh principle attached to our principles. Because I don't think the dominant power source wanted it there. So, we must thank folks who put us on that path. Okay. So I get to participate in the infinite. So I know my breathing, and I do that. And then the Buddha says, this still has not helped me unlock reality. This still does not help me move past suffering. That master says, you are an amazing student, for the second time. And this master's, I would say, a bit more enlightened, but he moves Buddha to a different place. Buddha, again, has to turn down the invitation to become a leader in that community. There's 300 students. Quite an honorable position, an important position. And Buddha says, no, I'm not finished. I still don't understand what I need to understand about reality. I still haven't moved past my deepest anxieties. I still don't fully understand suffering in this world. And he says, no. And then in this particular part of the world where he is, there's no more teachers. There are no more teachers. What is he to do? He says, I've got to go off on my own. I've got to understand this on my own. So he leaves, and in this process of meditation, one of the principles that he's been in this community is detachment from reality, detachment from phenomena, separation from the phenomena, separation from the world to try to get a sense for who you are, to move inward, to understand that you indeed participate in painting your reality and creating your reality, and there's a separation there. And he's still trying to understand the meaning of reality, suffering, and move past his anxieties from this principle of separation. He's still using that principle to help him move and to help him understand. So he goes out into the wilderness, and he begins this process of self-mortification. He doesn't eat, and for 6 months he doesn't bathe, he doesn't comb his hair is long, his clothes are falling off of him, and he's becoming weaker and weaker and weaker. And one day, after a hot day, he's sitting in meditation, and he feels a cool breeze on his cheek. And it's pleasant. And it's a good feeling. And it begins to occur to him, this is good. I'm part of this breeze. This feels good. What's going on that I have been under the illusion that I must separate myself, that I must abandon myself from the joys of meditation? And he says, not at all. I should be able to experience the joys of meditation and live out of meditation. It is okay that if I eat and I enjoy what I'm eating. As a matter of fact, I must recognize that I am part of this interdependent web of existence, and my sense of self needs to move into a boundaryless place where I have no self. That's a hard one for our culture. But we are so wrapped up into being ourselves and getting our needs met. We are solid with the self boundary around us. Our needs, our greatness, our empire, our rightness. We are the superpower on the earth. We have the greatest military that ever existed. We are great. This is what we hear over and over and again about who we are. And here we have this man. Clothes are falling off, skinny, and he recognizes the truth. No self for him at that point is enlightenment and the healthiest way to be. To stop and enjoy this life. He's weak. He makes the decision that he's going to eat, and he's going to go back, and he's going to find some friend that got lost along the way, and he's going to teach him this. But his friends see that he's changing, and they don't like the way he's changing because he's not beating himself up anymore. So they kind of leave him. He's so weak, he gets up and he falls down. And he's dying. The best I can read the story. He's dying. And one day, as he's there, this little girl, Sujata, who's gotten some food from her mother to take out to the forest gods, sees Siddhartha laying there, stops, and out of compassion, slowly begins to give him milk, slowly begins to nurture him, so that his eyes open up. He begins to see again. He begins to breathe again. He begins to come back to life. And as he comes back to life, this new teaching is within him. And he's got a desire to teach this new teaching. And who becomes his first students? Children become his first students. This 13-year-old girl becomes his first student. Soon, Savasti sees him meditating. If you remember the part of the story last week, sees him meditating in the woods. As Savasti sees him meditating, Savasti says, here's this beautiful man, dressed beautifully. And he's sitting so perfectly. And Savasti's just filled with the wonder of this man meditating, who, several months earlier, his skin was sagging and dying. And here's Savasti coming upon him at this point. Savasti begins to run to him. And then Savasti stops. What? And he's untouchable, and Buddha laughs. What do you mean? It's not even a consideration. So now we see Buddha's not angry about oppression. He doesn't confront oppression with strength. He laughs and he accepts and he welcomes this boy into his presence. He's moving now out of a state of compassion. He's moving now out of a state of understanding. He is living out of a state of compassion. He is living out of a state of understanding. So now, days later, months later, as he's sitting eating with Sujata and Savasti, and he's getting them to eat together, breaking down their self-imprisonment, he asks Savasti, what do you think of my statement that I love this bird, and this bird is part of who I am, and no, you can't have this bird? Savasti stops. Think about all the ways we are imprisoned. Think about all the beliefs we have accepted about ourselves. Think about all the beliefs we have learned about who we are as a people. All the beliefs that I've internalized about myself from my family of origin. Positive beliefs, negative self-beliefs, all the beliefs that limit me in this world, all the beliefs that I say I'm good enough for this, I'm not good enough for that, all the beliefs that I'll work hard all my life so that somebody else may have opportunities, but I'm not going to work hard in my life for me to have opportunities because there's something wrong with me, but I will help others do what they need to do. All the beliefs that we have inside of ourselves. Savasti, at that moment in time, is brought to a place where all the beliefs that held him bound to being an untouchable meet an invitation from somebody moving out of a state of compassion, out of experience with this compassion for weeks before in relationship with this man. And what do you think? What do you think is right? Love and understanding, or domination and possession? Domination and possession affirm Savasti's beliefs about himself as an untouchable. When he says, "I think you're right, Master," but not many people are going to think you're right, that is an amazing moment in time. He has left self-imprisonment and he has embraced life. He has moved from a way that moves toward death, and he has moved his life into a sense of life, and he has done it out of relationship. He has done that out of an experience of compassion and acceptance and welcoming of who he is and was as an untouchable. And his mind was worked with, so when that question was asked, he could finalize and begin that process of transformation and begin a spiritual journey which he could let go of his past and not be anxious about his future and be okay with himself in the here and now, so that he too could begin a journey of living out of compassion. We are all Savasti. We are all the Buddha asking others to move. We are all of those characters within us. The question we wrestle with, are we bringing ourselves to meals? Are we bringing ourselves to relationships where we will experience the confrontation of, which way do you think is right? Which way will you think about yourself? How will you touch others? That's the question we face. Will we bring ourselves to that lunch where those questions are going to be asked? Thank you.